had an agreement when they founded this Zionist state. Even the Zionist state was not a religious state. They are mixing religion with Zionism. At the beginning, the Jewish religion, the religious Jews were against the Zionist state. The Zionist state was founded by non-religious Jews. So then it came a mixture between religious Jews that wanted to found these Zionist states, and they created a symbiosis between religion, Jewish religion, and Zionism and Zionist political ideas. But that's not the original Jewish religion, and it was not also the Zionist project. It is a mixture of both. Well, it could be if they have a government that doesn't include rabbis or rabbinical parties, I mean religious parties like the Shas, if they have an election and they make a deal with all the parties that are not religious, they could make something to change the law.
Yes, we have that problem. This is it was in the beginning a small problem. It was a problem that some people can say this is not really happened, but today we know this is a big problem. I am a friend in a group in Israel of lawyers and professor in law, and this is what we do. We speak about that and we do some action to stop that. I don't think we can stop that now because it's so big, but maybe we can a little bit put the light on action that happened and put the woman outside over and over again all the time. I think now in Israel we stay in very bad situation. I think we go backward, and I think that a lot of people want to say this is like religion people that make that problem, but this is not only religion people, and it's not all of the religion people. This is a group of people that they have an interest, and this is what they want to do.
Thousands of couples are not able to get married at all, since going abroad is not an option due to the coronavirus pandemic, and the chief rabbinate will not perform a ceremony and provide legal recognition. The rabbinate standards and interpretations in these matters are generally used by the Israeli Interior Ministry in registering marriages and divorces. This legislation is amenable to the rabbinic establishment only. Many Israelis find they are turned away by the rabbinical authorities on the basis of Jewish law. Among them come from families who have immigrated to Israel from former Soviet republics and cannot provide the rabbinate with a required proof of their Judaism. Throughout the decades, there have been attempts to change the law. One such way is allowing civil marriages to be held by foreign governments under embassy ground. This had been thwarted by religious political parties that have historically held the deciding vote in coalition cabinets in Israel. Long before the coronavirus pandemic, hundreds of thousands of Israelis found themselves searching for options that included travel abroad or entering contractual cohabitation agreements just to validate their love and desire for family. For many Israelis, it has been and remains unacceptable that a person who is a citizen of Israel, a productive and law-abiding member of society, still does not have the most basic right to marry in Israel. This is why many are now calling for full civil marriage in Israel, which does not require any contact with a rabbinate for those who do not want it.
Well, the official government personnel will not help them very much, because in Israel, in order, for example, a young couple get married, if they want to go and get, let's say, mortgage to buy their first home from the government, some kind of assistance, they would not be able to do that because they are not recognized as a married couple. Okay? But for any practical purposes, they can be married. And there is a special status for people like that. For example, a man and a woman can live together, and they are, for all practical purposes, are married if they live together and they share their life. They don't need the official stamp. But if you need some official assistance from the government, for example, in questions of will and in question of inheritance and in question of buying a house and all that, so the government intervenes and it says, no, if you want our support, the government support, you need to be married according to our rule. And our rule are religious rules. That's the situation in Israel. So to some extent, it is a very troubling situation. Many people don't like it. Many people don't want the rabbi intervene in their life. Because, for example, if you want to divorce later on, you have to do it with some agreement of the rabbinate. Well, the rabbinate is a very powerful institution, but its power is not unlimited. It is quite limited, but they are very powerful. Why? Because they command and they control civic relations that people are so important for people, the question of marriage. Because Israel is defined as a Jewish state, Judaism has a very profound role in the political arrangement of the country. So the political parties, who are religious parties, throughout the years, were national system, but also in the religious sphere. So they are very powerful, but not unlimited force. The civil authorities also can limit their power. Yes, they can, but not, it is not a, depends on what issue. For example, we have in Israel the issue of a student, religious young people who study in religious institutions do not serve in the army. And many people resent that because they think that if you are a citizen, like everybody else, you have to pay taxes, you have to work, and you have to serve in the army like everybody else. In Israel, now it's quite a sizable minority of people who do not work and they study. And what they call that their studies is their work, because they study religious things. And the political parties who are religious parties defend this, their right not to serve in the army and not even to work, and that's especially a privilege for males, not so much for females. So there are many twists and many interesting things that have developed in Israel that were not that like that in Jewish communities before the state of Israel.
On social media, Israelis talk about fundamental issues. Ron Miretti says, as a Jew, this rabbinate bothers me. No one should be able to tell me I'm not Jewish enough. You want to continue to lose internal support? That's how you do it. Angry Dad says, Israel is now largely statutory, and there are specific laws putting family law matters, including matrimonial and divorce, in the jurisdiction of the rabbinate.
They have to go to another country, but I heard that it's a new news that the Norwegian from Norway government made a deal, a solution that they could marry by civil law in their embassy in Israel, so they don't have to travel to other countries to do that. That could be to Arabs, immigrants, not religious people, LGBT community, etc., etc. You know, this law in Israel, it's a mixture of secular law inherited by the British rule. The British inherited all the law except the marriages, the civil law for the marriages and the family law. So it is a mixture. It is not a theocratical law. It is not a democratically law. It is some mixture. So it has to be a solution to help all these people who want to marry, and make some changes in this kind of mixture law between religious and secular judges.
Norway has offered to allow Israelis to get civil marriages at their embassy and consulate, as coronavirus restrictions have prevented them from traveling to Cyprus. Cyprus is a common destination for civil marriages. The issue is being debated, but it's not new. The concept of allowing Israelis to marry on foreign embassy grounds has been proposed before, but religious political parties did not allow it then. And now many believe that they will not allow it to happen, even in these distressful, uncertain times. This is why many in Israel despise the rabbinate. More and more Israelis are calling for its disbandment. Of course, that would be highly unlikely, as it is too powerful and it's essentially part of the Israeli regime. For now, Israelis just can't have a civil marriage. Here's the news making the press in Israel. Ynet News, a report by the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants NGO, describes subhuman conditions and treatment akin to torture, such as being hit with belts, lack of contact with the outside world, and just moments of free time in the open air. The report by the Hotline for Refugees and Migrants for 2019 gathered dozens of testimonies, which also revealed shocking incidents at several migrant detention facilities where those suspected of visa violations, illegal entry, or unauthorized arrival are detained while the authorities work to find out if they are residing in Israel legally. The Times of Israel weekly protests against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu continue amid wintry weather, as demonstrators gathered in plazas, intersections, and overpasses throughout and across Israel for the rallies, now on their 22nd week. Police detained four people during the rally, and a woman in her 60s was taken for medical treatment after allegedly being shoved to the ground by a cop. The Jerusalem Post, Israel police is expected to submit indictments against leaders of the protests against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the coming days. The indictments are expected to be for offenses such as obstructing an on-duty officer and violence against police officers. Senior police officers have said that a lot of pressure has been applied to the state attorney to approve the indictments, according to Haaretz. Police must have state attorney authorization for indictments, including those that they are able to issue independently. This is designed to prevent the police from being able to limit freedom of speech. Globes, Governor of the Bank of Israel Amir Yaron presented a forecast of a debt GDP ratio of 87% in 2023 without spending cuts. Israel will have to make substantial budget cuts starting from 2022 in order to avoid a downgrade of its credit rating, Governor of the Bank of Israel Amir Yaron.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
As the Saudi-led U.S.-backed assault on the impoverished nation of Yemen continues, food prices are spiking alongside a collapsing domestic currency, a situation the WFP chief described as a huge blow in a country that imports 80% of its food. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stencil Ryder. This article is published under the heading Receiving Nobel Prize, World Food Program Chief Warns, We Are Losing Battle Against Hunger. Here's the details of this article. Because of so many wars, climate change, the widespread use of hunger as a political and military weapon, and a global health pandemic that makes all of that exponentially worse, 270 million people are marching toward starvation. Those were the words uttered by the United Nations World Food Programme WFP Executive Director David Beasley on Thursday, December 10th, as he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize on behalf of the International Aid Organization, which was chosen in October to win the esteemed award that the diplomat said cannot erase the shameful persistence of hunger. The Nobel Peace Prize is more than a thank you, Beasley said during his speech. It is a call to action. In an interview conducted ahead of his acceptance speech, Beasley told Time that next year is looking catastrophic. The hardest work is yet to come for WFP because the needs of 2021 are going to be so critical that failure to address those needs will result in war, famine, and mass migration. I feel quite today, but also a sense of shame I cannot seem to shake, wrote Beasley in a recent op-ed published by The Guardian. There is failure in this victory. We are having our media moment while hunger still rages. According to Beasley, we're losing the battle against hunger as never before, and we are losing it most in Yemen. He continued, I know that just as WFP receives this coveted award, in a nameless village in Yemen, a skeletal child will be hovering close to death, hooked to a feeding tube. I've met these frail Yemeni children most often in hot and dusty clinics filled with flies. The mothers usually give up on shooing the flies away and sit quietly by their sides. When you enter the room, they pray you are in the Western miracle that has come to save their child. You know you're not, and you could not be more uncomfortable. On occasion, a child will grab your hand or finger. You really want that to happen, but you hate it at the same time because you fear the feeding tube may not do its job. It gets so hard to control your feelings, but you simply cannot let the child's mother see tears in your eyes. The WFP Beasley said, reflects both the best and worst in humanity. It exists because many of us care, and it exists because many of us do not. Last week, WFP and its partners UNICEF and the Food and Agriculture Organization issued yet another appeal for Yemen as the crisis intensifies again, he said. But in the midst of horror of the COVID pandemic, it is a struggle to get any notice. Beasley added that we cannot let hunger simply fade into the background in the age of COVID-19. While acknowledging that times are tougher now than at any point in most of our lifetimes, he pointed out that last year, hunger and malnutrition claimed twice as many children's lives as COVID-19 has claimed worldwide so far, more than 3 million. The WFP leader is convinced that if we are determined, we can succeed in ameliorating the suffering of starving Yemenis and millions of others around the world. Beasley assessed the deteriorating conditions in Yemen, which he characterized as a country in chaos. As the Saudi-led U.S.-backed assault on the impoverished nation of Yemen continues, food prices are spiking alongside a collapsing domestic currency, a situation the WFP chief described as a huge blow in a country that imports 80% of its food. Millions are food insecure, and famine-like conditions have begun to appear, Beasley wrote. What is happening in Yemen now is a shame. We all share that shame, and we need to end it together, he said.
European News Bulletin.
This is News Bulletin. My name is Amina Taylor. Now we kick things off with some rather depressing news with Britain's economy. As it walks the fine line between a health crisis and an economic catastrophe, the UK government says its priority is to save jobs. But the latest figures tell a different story. Unemployment in the 3 months to October rose to nearly 5%, with redundancy setting a new record. More in this report by Saeed Puriza.
Britons woke up to more worrying news this December morning. 19,000 fewer workers out of paid employment in November than at the start of the health crisis, meaning coronavirus continues to weigh heavily on the UK labour market.
Is this the direct impact of the pandemic on the UK's labour market?
The problem started before the coronavirus, and the measures being taken are only glossing over the realities. The system is fundamentally flawed. Rich-poor division has got more extreme. The type of jobs coming in are not the old secure, well-paid jobs. They're the insecure, low-paid, temporary jobs.
Released by the Office for National Statistics, The report also says there has been a record rise in redundancies in the 3 months to October, 370,000 of them. Worst hit, those in the hospitality sector, teetering during the pandemic. The government says its measures are necessary for beating the virus.
We've put a lot of work in over the past month. There's been enormous sacrifice on everyone's part, and we want to make sure that we continue suppressing the virus. The good news is that we've made improvements, whether it's in mass testing or early promising news on vaccines.
While the prospect of a functioning vaccine has injected some optimism into people's lives, experts say the next few months are likely to remain very challenging.
Do you think more people are going to be out of work in the coming months?
Yes. They will falsify the figures, and they do that by they've done this for years and years, and they massage out of the figures people who are really unemployed.
Add to the mix the immediate impact of a no-deal Brexit, the UK leaving the European Union without a trade deal at the end of this month.
There's also the fact that the unemployment figures don't tell the whole story. There's always a lag in the data. And the government's job retention scheme, also known as the furlough scheme, is propping up the labor market, for now.
In November, the UK Chancellor warned the number of unemployed people in the country was expected to surge to 2.6 million by the middle of next year. And that may be a conservative figure. The fact is that COVID-19 is here to stay, and it'll be months, if not longer, for everyone to be vaccinated. The unforgiving equation is that the tighter the measures to protect lives, the more devastating the impact on livelihoods. Saeed Pariza, London.
And Shabir Razvi, the economic analyst, joins us from central London for his reaction to these grim statistics. Shabir, we know that vaccines are going to be rolled out, providing something of a respite here. But what about the economic consequences of this pandemic?
Yes, I mean, whether the vaccine is a sort of panacea that everyone's been looking for is a different topic altogether. But I think what one has to realize, as in your opening comments from the other interviewee, was that really the inequalities that we have been experiencing over the last 10 years due to the austerity measures which have been applied very aggressively in the UK and the pandemic fallout reinforces these inequalities. And what you've got to really understand is that the long economic hangover of the pandemic could really last for another generation very easily. So you're talking about not just a decade, but perhaps two or three decades, fallout that we would be experiencing in the British economy. You know, the figures are quite dire as far as unemployment is concerned. Conservatively, 2.5 million, you know, some economists are talking about twice as many as that over the last few months since the whole economic measures that have been applied mm-hmm. by the Chancellor is literally printing money, giving people, you know, they've been furloughed, and all that kind of measures have really, in a way, softened the impact that Indeed. We would have felt in the last few months. Come March, when all these things are going to be taken away, we'll really see a dramatic impact, even worse than what we have been facing for the last 9 months. This is not sort of, you know, just Indeed. Doom and gloom that I'm talking about, but that's the reality that we would be facing come New Year.
Indeed, Shabir. And before I let you go, the UK has performed the worst out of the G7 nations. You have any sympathy for Boris Johnson's predicament in this?
Do I have any sympathy? That's a very leading question. You know, I don't think anyone in the UK has sympathy for Boris Johnson at all. Whether, you know, sort of managing the whole health crisis or the reality that managing even Brexit, which we are sort of, you know, 2 weeks away from really coming out of the European Union completely, has that been managed properly? You know, the verdict is out that perhaps the night of long knives will be taking place in the Tory party
Indeed.
Very soon in the new year, and whether Mr. Boris Johnson last the whole of the parliamentary session.
Indeed, Chabert.
Majority of 80, whether, you know, is going to continue as prime minister is also an open question.
Well, he'll probably be hoping that the furlough schemes last a little bit longer. He might need it. We'll leave it there, Chabert Rizvi. Thank you. Now to some other news, because Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has hit back after Washington imposed sanctions on Turkey's defense infrastructure after they purchased Russia's S-400 surface-to-air missile defense system.
It is upsetting. The rhetoric of sanctions against our country in the United States and the European Union has increased and the processes have been mobilized. We expect our NATO ally, the United States, to support our battle against terrorist organizations, not sanctions. But this does not mean that we'll remain silent when our rights, laws, and sovereignty is being trampled upon.
The sanctions target the chairman of Turkey's leading defense procurement and development body, alongside three senior members of the management team. Last year, Turkey was removed from Washington's F-35 jet program. Well, Professor İlter Turan from Istanbul Bilgi University joins us for this one. And Professor Turan, good to talk to you. The U.S. threatened sanctions, now they're delivering. Can Erdogan and his party be surprised here?
Well, this has been talked about for a long time. It was tried before. Other sanctions have applied before in different ways. So it's not surprising that a new set of sanctions are being put into implementation. What seems to be surprising is that it is coming in the last days of the Trump administration, and it seems to be more an initiative of Mr. Pompeo than Trump himself.
Will this push Turkey further towards Russia and China? Because it seems, you know, NATO members falling out here is a little bit uncomfortable for the rest of their colleagues.
But that type of discomfort had been in existence for a long time. And Turkey had been trying to develop its own arms industry and secure the types of armaments it needs from a variety of sources. So since the conditions that had sort of called for Turkey's finding armaments elsewhere had been in effect for a long time, I don't think the particular decision produced at this particular time will cause any fundamental shifts. But it is clearly a sort of insulting and a gesture that further undermines Turkey's confidence in its allies.
Because the issue here is NATO as a natural fit for Ankara. We've had the situation in the Eastern Med with fellow NATO allies Greece on this one. Now we're having this situation with the United States. Is NATO really the place for Turkey?
Well, we have a history of intra alliance disputes that go far back into, for example, 1964, when Turkey got a very undiplomatic letter from Mr. Johnson. So this is the way it seems that the alliances operate. It seems that it is probably not prudent for Turkey to consider leaving NATO, because Turkey has to balance a variety of forces that are operating on it, and each force is countered by its affiliation with another alliance. And despite the various problems between Turkey and NATO, nobody knows under what conditions NATO will come to Turkey's defense. And that element of lack of information or unpredictability is, believe it or not, a source of a source of support for Turkey in its international activities.
Indeed, Professor İlter Turan there. Always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
And Robert Carter, we heard what Professor Turan had to say from an analyst's perspective on this one. But what's been the social media reaction to this story? Because after all, Washington and Ankara going at it, it's not good diplomatic news for anybody.
Absolutely, Amina. The online reaction has been pretty significant, both by typical social media users who have been keeping an eye on the news as it develops, but also the official online reaction has been pretty heavy, with other countries weighing in to the crisis as it's developing into, including the Islamic Republic of Iran, who have actually taken to Twitter to express their condemnation of the Western sanction policy in general. And it was actually the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who offered some support to their regional neighbor as it faces unjust sanctions, as it's been described. So perhaps we'll bring up some of those reactions now, Amina, going straight to Javad Zarif here, who said via Twitter that the U.S. and their addiction to sanctions and contempt for international law at full display once again. We strongly condemn recent U.S. sanctions against Turkey and stand with its people and government. Obviously, Iran is no stranger to U.S. sanctions. It's one of the most sanctioned countries in the world and has actually described U.S. sanctions policy as economic terrorism in the past. Turkey is just getting a little sample of what that feels like with this latest sanctions move. The next tweet I have is actually from the U.S. themselves, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, trying to explain as to why they took the move that they did, saying that despite U.S. warnings, Turkey moved ahead with its purchase and testing of this S-400 system from Russia, which is what this sanctions is all about. We will not tolerate significant transactions with Russia's defense sector. And then third and final tweet I have on this is from Turkey's foreign minister himself, who's also weighed in, making very clear that sanctions won't change Turkey's position in the Mediterranean or the region at all. So obviously a new phase in this sanctions warfare, if you like. We'll have to wait and see how Turkey responds, but they have made very clear that this is an unprecedented escalation in the relationship between the US and Turkey, and of course Iran playing a positive role, as it always does, in supporting its regional neighbors during these times.
All right, we move from a crisis there to a potential crisis. Tell me where and with whom.
Absolutely. So moving over to the Red Sea now, there's been a major attack that's taken place targeting an oil tanker that was anchored off of the Saudi port city of Jeddah just mere hours ago, in fact. According to reports, it appears that a smaller boat that was laden with explosives was driven into the tanker, leading to the explosion. Now, obviously, there is a lot of speculation as to who is behind this attack, but it has been linked to Saudi Arabia's ongoing aggressive war against the Yemeni people. Obviously, Yemen has used several retaliatory measures in order to try and force the Saudis to alleviate their aggression on the country, and it's speculated that this may be a boat attack that could have originated from Yemen, but we have yet to confirm those details. But what I can bring you is, of course, a significant online reaction to the attack. Many people putting the blame firmly on Saudi Arabia for essentially starting a war in the region and de-escalating the Red Sea area, which has led to these types of incidents. It's not unprecedented now to see attacks on Saudi soil. Let's go to the first YouTube comment that I have. It's from Darker Life, who says, "I think this is all made up by the Saudi government to blame Iran on the command of Israel." Obviously, Saudi media has been quick to blame Iran and their regional allies for this alleged attack without much proof, I have to say. Let's go to the next YouTube comment I have. This is from Sane, who says, "Did the fat cats in Saudi really expect to have it easy whilst destroying other countries, facilitating crippling sanctions?" And finally, from Angel, who says on YouTube again, "Saudi Arabia complaining about terrorism? Well, that joke just writes itself."
I shall refrain from chortling. Thank you, Robert Carter. We leave it there until next time. And we stay in the British capital now, because London will be placed under the country's highest level of COVID-19 restriction from midnight local time. This as a new virus strain has been spotted among the rapidly rising infection rates. Health Secretary Matt Hancock announced that London and its surrounding areas will be moved into Tier 3 restrictions. This so far has covered 60% of England's population.
Over the last few days, thanks to our world-class genomic capability in the UK, we have identified a new variant of coronavirus which may be associated with the fastest spread in the southeast of England. Initial analysis suggests that this variant is growing faster than the existing variants.
According to the latest reports, the new variant spreads at a faster rate but has the same impact on the body. To Germany now, where the country's Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union will elect a new party chairman and potential successor to the German leader at a two-day virtual congress beginning on January the 15th. At stake is the leadership of Europe's biggest economy after Merkel, who's vowed not to run again at elections due next autumn, having been largely present on the European stage since 2005. Armin Laschet, the moderate leader of Germany's most populous state, and Friedrich Merz, a longtime Merkel adversary from the right wing of the party, are the frontrunners. Also in the race is foreign policy expert Norbert Rothagen. Opinion polls have shown conservative Merz is more popular with CDU members than his opponents. French President Emmanuel Macron has vowed to hold a referendum to add France's commitment to fighting climate change to the country's constitution. Macron has been under fire from left-wing factions of his centrist party for failing to do enough to combat global warming, despite pledges to spend billions of euros to speed up moves towards a greener economy. The announcement comes at a time when Macron's support base ahead of the 2022 elections continues to be eroded. This has resulted in him announcing a slew of legislation targeting, quote, so-called extremist Islamic ideologies alongside climate change. This in a bid to attract more voters. Robert Inlakesh, it's a story we looked at yesterday, but I dare say there has not been any kind of remedy offered up to WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange. What have you been finding out for us?
Well, of course, we've heard these allegations coming out in the past days and months of human rights violations being committed against Julian Assange, him not having proper access to the things that he needs. We heard Assange's partner decry the atrocious prison conditions in which he is living. And then what we heard yesterday, and this sparked controversy online, was that possibly Trump was going to go ahead and pardon Julian Assange. That was then slapped down as coming from a faulty source. However, there is still rumors which are circulating as to whether Trump will pardon Assange, who is being tried under the Espionage Act. That's what he's being charged with. And also Edward Snowden. But unfortunately, this speculation that's been going around has not been confirmed at the moment.
Indeed. The online reaction to this, Rich?
The first one we've got here is from Richard Medhurst, who says, "Real Donald Trump needs to pardon Snowden and Julian Assange, although I don't like this term pardon. In the case of Assange, Assange is not guilty of anything. He's not even American. He owes the U.S. nothing. The U.S. owes the world reparations and an end to empire." We've got another one here as well from Stephen, who says, "The establishment media smeared Julian Assange because the establishment wanted to undermine his support, but you cannot silence the glaring truth. Julian Assange is a completely innocent journalist who exposed war crimes, torture, and corruption. His support grows. Hashtag free Assange now."
And for those who are following the case, they might remember that it's, of course, live with something of a verdict or a judgment expected when the courts reopen in January, I believe, of 2021. And that moves us on to our next story. Russian hackers, says Washington. Explain.
Well, it's quite a hilarious story that's been produced by the media here, in that they're accusing instantly Russian hackers of hacking into the U.S. Treasury. and spying on U.S. federal agencies. However, even in these articles, you will read that the United States government has not officially announced that this was Russia. However, the media, you know, go on their claims of they always source unnamed U.S. officials. It's always unnamed that are supposedly claiming this. And then we've got the hours and hours of anti-Russia smears all over the media. And still the claims that Donald Trump is somehow a Russian puppet, even though, of course, Donald Trump has been one of the hardest presidents in recent history on Russia, this is never enough for the U.S. media, and they continue to claim that Trump is somehow owned by Putin. And on top of that as well, what we're seeing is this sort of feeds into this new McCarthyism sort of era where you can't even defend Russia or China when clearly these allegations are false or they're unfounded. And it feeds into what we're seeing is really a new Red Scare that's happening. You know, we're trying to accuse Russia and China of everything bad in this world in an attempt to justify sanctions and justify military aggression overseas.
So let me see if I get this wrong. On one hand, Trump is in the pocket of Putin, but on the other hand, the Russians are using cyber technology to attack Trump's institutions. That's an interesting one. The online reaction, please. I'm a little confused. I wonder if social media would clarify that for me.
Well, people seem to be very confused online as well. The first one we've got here is from a Twitter user who says, U.S. Treasury hacked yesterday, Google got down today. All the pieces are being set into motion for the 2020 grand finale. We've got another one here who says, the U.S. Treasury was hacked by a foreign government group. These implications are serious. Our first line of defense is a DHS agency called CISA. Its leadership was crippled after Trump fired Chris Krebs for saying the election was the most secure in American history. So a bit of criticism there of Trump, but seems to be all over the place on Twitter in terms of the criticisms and how people are interpreting this.
So who benefits from this?
Well, of course, they're trying to push Donald Trump as far right as possible when it comes to Russia, and they've succeeded in this, even if you look at his withdrawal from the short and long range missile treaties and what he's done. He's set the stage for perhaps a war in the future with somewhere like Venezuela because of this. So basically, the establishment, these neoliberals and neoconservatives, are getting all they want by claiming that Russia owns Trump, whilst Trump does all he can to prove that he's not owned by Russia, and, of course, is taking a hard line against Russia and sanctioning and doing everything he can to be as far right-leaning as possible.
Indeed, as if to say, look, I couldn't possibly be after this. Robert Inukesh, thank you so much, and, of course, thanks to you for staying the course with us, they say.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Jafar al-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
I have said this many times to our dear nation and to officials in various public and private meetings. We should strengthen our means of power, real, not fake power. The nation and the country should become strong. If this happens, the enemy will be hopeless. The people have really stood firm by enduring the existing problems, and they have shown steadfastness. In my opinion, officials should have more movement in three areas. One is in the area of the economy, another is in the area of security, and the last is in the area of culture. We officials should increase our efforts in these three areas. In the area of the economy, the right to attitude is to avoid pinning our hopes on the outside. This does not mean that we should cut off our relations. Whenever I say that we should seek the cure inside the country, some people go and write online that the leadership believes in cutting off relations with the outside, but this is not what I say. Relations should be kept in place.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
The important thing is that we should not ask others and foreigners to give us the cure, because the cure exists in us and in the country, an important element of which is increasing production. I have stressed this matter many times. There should be a planned and organized effort in the area of the economy. Many of our current problems have nothing to do with sanctions and the like. These problems are related to our own performance and to lack of harmony. The recent high prices cannot be really be justified. Many of the recent exorbitant prices are unjustifiable. They should and can be cured. Officials should resolve this problem with harmony. When one looks, one sees that the price of products ranging from red meat, chicken and tomatoes to diapers has gone up. Well, there is no reason behind the recent prices. And there are enough products in the country.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Around the world with reporters.
More than 4 years since Britain voted by 52 to 48% to leave the EU, a trade deal is yet to be reached. after it became clear that the UK is hurtling towards a no-deal Brexit, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said Sunday, the two sides are still very far apart on some key issues, but the UK will not be leaving the negotiating table.
What I'll say is I think that the UK should continue to try. And I think that's what the people of this country would want me to do. We're going to continue to try.
Mr. Johnson also called on Britain to get ready to trade on World Trade Organization terms. The UK will also have to decide whether to accept the mini-deals proposed by Brussels to keep planes in the air and lorries with food and medicines rolling. A no-deal might mean rising food prices and the loss of 300,000 jobs. So are Britons worried?
There's scary things like there might not be food on the shelves, like in January and February, because it's going to be a nightmare getting everything through customs. There's the whole Irish border thing. I mean, I can just go on and on and on.
I think, you know, leaving the European Union is a very, very bad idea. I think the decision was probably made by the old people, and the young people have to cope with it in the future.
Boris has let everybody down, left, right and centre. He promised the earth, he promised this ready cooked deal, and he's just not delivered in any shape or form. It's dreadful. But on the other hand, we can't be blackmailed by Europe.
Preventing a deal is a row over Britain's fisheries. After January 1st, Europe won't have automatic access to British waters anymore, and a no deal will mean zero access. The French are particularly upset about this. Clashes in the English Channel are likely, and the UK has already bolstered its defences there with four Royal Navy ships. The EU is calling for calm, though.
Great Britain and Europe are friends, partners, allies, and this will remain the case after Brexit.
The EU's Brexit negotiator is also calling for patience, saying a new trade pact with Britain is still possible this week.
Trade of goods and services, fishing, energy, transport, the security of citizens. Never have we negotiated such an agreement in such a short space of time. We've only been negotiating for 9 months.
The EU says that Westminster has to compromise on fisheries, but the UK says it cannot be the only country in the world that does not have sovereign control over its fishing waters. Neither seem prepared to budge, and despite a new deadline, it seems a no-deal Brexit is more and more likely. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The US-backed opposition leader Juan Guaido has once again tried to cause instability in the country by staging a protest vote. Guaido launched a so-called popular consultation vote, asking people to dismiss the legitimacy of the parliamentary elections and the presidency of Nicolas Maduro. The elections, which was boycotted by the opposition, saw the ruling Socialist Party winning more than two-thirds of the seats. Although Guaido said millions of people took part in the event, very few people were seen attending the consultation polling stations. Government officials rejected Guaido's consultation vote, saying he has no political leadership to lead such an event.
Guaido's popularity is tumbling down, and every day he has fewer supporters. He no longer represents the country's opposition.
Nonetheless, a few still stand by Guaido and his political role.
As long as Guaido has the support of the U.S., he will be a political leader and his voice will be heard.
But analysts say Guaido's links with the U.S. are not enough to make him a successful leader, as many have abandoned him in Venezuela.
Opposition members who ran in the past legislative elections broke ties with Guaido due to his anti-electoral stance. His popularity is quickly melting down.
Opposition figure Juan Guaido, the guy who the U.S. still calls interim president of Venezuela, seems to be left alone by most of his former allies and followers, as fewer and fewer people respond to the events he calls own in his own country. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
The United States doesn't elect their leader by a popular vote, but by an electoral college. And that group has just chosen Democrat Joe Biden to be the president-elect of the United States. Biden was selected amid bitter, unfinished, but as yet unproven accusations of massive electoral fraud. Polls consistently show that around 35% of the country believes Biden won due to voter fraud, and the challenges to the nation's electoral integrity seem certain to continue until January 6th, when Congress officially counts the electoral votes.
Trump is going to just keep going on doing what he does, and that's not to the benefit of the country, but obviously we're just moving along, following the rules, and hopefully the democracy is strong enough to keep going.
President Biden going to be in office. This